Good evening and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Carrie Curtis, a member of the club's Board of Governors and your host for the evening. It's my pleasure to introduce today's special guest. Ted Rice is Senior Portfolio Manager at Merrill Lynch in San Francisco. He's had 31 years of experience in investment management portfolio management and working with customers, both individual customers and corporate customers. In the spirit of full disclosure, I will say that he is the financial advisor to the Commonwealth Club. Another negative about him is that he went to Stanford. He went to Stanford, and we did not come to blows in the lead-up go Bears. But anyway, Ted lives in San Francisco with his wife and two kids, and where he's lived for many years. And without further ado, I give you Ted Rice.
Well, the kids, is that volume okay? The kids don't live in San Francisco anymore because they seem to be growing up and going off to college. But Carrie, thank you very much for that nice introduction. And I'd like to thank the club again for inviting me here to speak this evening. Most of all, thanks to all of you. I really appreciate your investing some time and coming out to hear tonight's session. As Carrie mentioned, I'm really lucky to say it's my 31st year in the investment world. I got into the industry. I'm not going to give you my life story, don't worry. I got into the industry right after college, and I really didn't know anything about it. Went to work for a small firm that a family friend owned. Started out as a wire operator. There's a term that isn't even in use anymore these days. And right away, I became absolutely fascinated by the financial markets. What makes them tick? What makes them move? Why did they move so dramatically sometimes? How did they change so dramatically over time, sometimes quickly? What were the opportunities and dangers they would tee up? Started reading Barron's. What made for those people that had those track records that the University of Chicago Business School, hope there's no alums, couldn't explain? What made for successful investment strategies? So I hope some of what I've seen and learned, and it's a lot for anybody if you've been in the industry 5 years, given what happened in 08. But I hope some of what I've seen and learned might help give you some perspective on the current environment for some of these financial markets, because in many ways the environment's really unprecedented, and it's sort of a whole new ballgame when you think about what's happened over the past 5 or 6 years in some ways. Now, before we start, of course, just the few obligatory words from our friends in legal and compliance. None of what follows is a recommendation or solicitation to buy any securities, and it is certainly not tax advice. I'm no CPA, never will be. And except where I specifically note the sources, the opinions and observations are 100% my own, not those of Merrill Lynch or any other firm. Okay, with that, let's get into the topic. Investing in troubled times, or where are the opportunities, or some of the opportunities, in the post-financial crisis world? Now, a subtitle might be, how do we earn a return in a zero interest rate world? Because I don't know about you, but I did a little research over the weekend. That's what people like me do, I guess. Some money fund out there somewhere yields 0.5%, supposedly. I don't know where it is, because according to Barron's, the average money market fund, and this is a little bit more realistic, is yielding less than 0.1%. But even if you could earn 0.5%, it would take 138 years for your money to double. Not so hot. So let's see if we can do something better. Let's see if we look hard, and yes, with some risks, we have to assume, can we earn 2 times that, 3 times that, 5 times that? How about 10 times that? Maybe even with some tax advantages. Let's look. But first, let's go back to the crisis. When the crisis hit 3 years ago, it was a credit crisis. When Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy, all of a sudden people, companies, countries became unwilling to lend to each other. And if it taught us anything, it taught us that this world does run on credit. The system seized up, and commerce almost ground to a halt. Now, the questions of what caused the crisis, did the authorities do the right thing during the middle of the crisis, those are topics for another day. Suffice it to say that the credit markets did recover, and they continue to function pretty much normally today. But parts of the crisis live on. One of the hangovers that remains is, again, these super low interest rates engineered by our Federal Reserve. And as we all know, we might be in sort of post-crisis mode here in the U.S., but the situation in Europe kind of looks like a crisis to me and probably you too. And it sort of seems to be simmering over there, maybe even getting close to boiling. But when you think about it for a second, the way I look at it, we should be grateful for some bad news and some lingering effects of these crises, because they cause investors to run away from risk. They cause investors to demand higher returns from assets. They can even cause investors to become panicked and irrational, and that can lead to dislocations and inefficiencies in pricing of investment assets. And conditions like those can create good opportunities for investors who are willing to go against the crowd and invest when others are completely afraid to. We often get compensated the most when other people aren't willing to invest and be compensated at all, which is the case right now. I can't remember the amount of money that's in money market funds earning zero now, but it's in the trillions. So when you get right down to it, as investors, we almost need bad news or crises to bring about good opportunities. After all, as one fellow put it recently in Barron's, you can have good investment values, you can have good news in the headlines, but you just can't have them at the same time. So let's look at some of these possible opportunities. You might expect me to start talking about stocks right about now. But before we go there, let's look at some potential opportunities in the world of bonds. Now, some of you hearing that might start thinking, bonds? What's he talking about bonds for? Aren't interest rates on bonds really low now? Haven't bonds been in a 30-year bull market since the early 1980s? Haven't I read about a bond market bubble? Well, there are bonds and there are bonds. These days, treasury bonds and other really high-quality corporate and tax-free muni bonds don't offer generous yields. And that's an understatement. But some less well-known and, yes, higher-risk areas of the bond markets may be offering opportunities that deserve a look. Let's take a look at a couple of them first. The world of high-yield muni and high-yield corporate bonds. High yield, by the way, was sort of invented by Michael Milken. It's a polite term for what used to be called junk bonds, but we're in polite company. Let's call them high yield. These sectors consist of bonds that are rated either below investment grade or they're not rated at all by the rating agencies. Again, a topic for another day is how credible are the rating agencies given some of the insanity that happened with highly rated securities, supposedly, in the 08 experience, but we'll leave that for another day. Anyway, below investment grade or unrated bonds, of course, investors in those bonds demand higher interest rates to be compensated for the risk of buying them and owning them. And when credit conditions get iffy, the most dramatic example, of course, being 3 years ago, or the headlines get scary like this summer in Europe, and the financial markets get nervous, investors demand even more interest from these securities. Again, that's a polite way of saying that these bonds can go down. And they can go down a lot in the market. But we have to remember they're bonds. They're not stocks. A stock can go down and stay down. There's nothing that says it has to go back up. But bonds are contractual obligations. The issuer, who offered the bonds, has to continuously pay the interest to the owners, investors in the bonds. And they have to pay back the bond's face value on a date certain when it matures. So, quick example. Let's say a given bond is issued in the marketplace at 100 cents on the dollar, its face value, but it declines in the market because of these conditions. The market's nervous, the market demands a higher yield. So now the bond is trading at 85 cents on the dollar. Well, at that point, investors who might buy the bond are facing two, and pretty much only two outcomes, sort of binary. They'll make a gain of 17% between the purchase price of 85 and the maturity value of 100, plus the interest they earn, or, and this is the bad part, the issuer breaks the contract and is in default. But there's not really a third outcome. It's not like Sun Microsystems that used to be 65 and then it goes to 6, then it stays there and there's a take under at 8, 10 years later. That outcome doesn't really happen in the bond world. Let's leave bankruptcy aside for a second. Now, back to the default scenario. When that happens, it doesn't usually result in anything like a total loss. You don't get back zero, but it takes a long time and it's really ugly. We don't want to go there. So buying one or two of these bonds or a handful of them and picking them yourself can be really dangerous. We don't do that. They don't even let us do that, thank goodness. But what if we invested in a dozen of these bonds from different issuers What if we bought 20 bonds or 50 bonds or a few hundred bonds? And what if we didn't try to pick the bonds ourselves, because one is not a credit analyst? What if we hired someone who was a really good credit analyst, or they had a team of 50 credit analysts that could research and select the bonds for us and monitor them? Well, those two things might change the odds of having a positive outcome, especially over the long term, a lot. You might have guessed from those last two ideas I just mentioned, broad diversification and deep credit research, the way to accomplish that is to invest in a bond mutual fund as opposed to buying individual bond issues. And I stress the long-term part of the outcome for a really important reason. If you look at a graph of the prices of these bond funds, I'll do it from left to right for you, it looks like a gigantic U. These bonds went down a lot in 2008. It was nothing shy of horrific. But they came all the way back up, and they paid interest along the way. Not every single bond, but the bond funds did. The important message here to me is that investors who lost their resolve and got out during the downdraft took some really serious losses, but people who were willing to stay invested did fine. And those who were able to add to their investments got some really incredible returns. None of this is to say, of course, the future downdrafts will have the same outcome. But I think we can say that 08 and 09 were pretty much a trial by fire for these markets, and they made it. And while investing in those dark days was an incredible opportunity, I could tell you some stories. I think you'll probably agree with me when I say that I hope we never see a, quote, opportunity like 2008 ever again. But what's the outlook now? If these markets have recovered a lot, is there still opportunity? Let's take a look at each of them one at a time. First, high yield, the tax-exempt, the municipal bonds. In 2008, even though it was temporary, even high-grade munis saw price declines which no one expected or had ever experienced before. Most of these declines had very little, if anything, to do with the issuer's creditworthiness, their ability to pay the interest and the maturity value, but instead they were caused by investors who were selling in a panic, or investors, the most dangerous thing, forced to sell because of margin calls. They had bought the bonds with borrowed money. Now, if you're sitting there wondering, and I hope you would, who in the world would buy municipal bonds with borrowed money on margin? It was a favorite trick of hundreds and hundreds of overleveraged hedge funds. What a neat trick. I got a great idea. Let's borrow a whole bunch of money in Japan at 1%. Let's buy a bunch of bonds that yield 5. We get that 4 difference. And hey, what if we leveraged it 5 times? Then we'd be making 20%. Think of those fees we'd be earning. Our investors would be paying and we'd be earning. Nice work if you can get it, until a 25 or 30% drop blows you out of the water completely and you're shut down and out of business and are never coming back, which is exactly what happened to hundreds and hundreds of these folks. Back to our story. After that craziness was going on, after the recovery began, muni bonds enjoyed enormous price rebounds in 2009 and 2010. Then, some of you may remember this, in December 2010, a real prominent analyst named Meredith Whitney, who had correctly called some of the financial crisis before it really happened, to her credit, in 2007, she was interviewed on 60 Minutes one Sunday night, and she made this very brash and bold and very powerful sounding call that the muni market was soon to face imminently hundreds of billions of dollars of defaults. Well, that call ended up proving out to be spectacularly incorrect and almost dead wrong. But at the time, again, we were still a little closer in time to the crisis, and it really scared people, and it caused a huge, massive wave of selling by retail investors. The muni market is one of the few where individuals like you and I are the primary participants as opposed to the institutions. Point of that being, for the second time in as many years, there was a huge sell-off in these muni markets that investors never expected and had never experienced. They just don't usually act that way. So those shocks, and those shocks being in everybody's memory, plus the ongoing scary headlines about state muni finances that you can read every day, seem to have the great majority of investors in munis focused primarily on investment-grade bonds, and therefore the below investment grade sector might be suffering from neglect, or avoidance, maybe we should call it. Now, below investment grade, again, sounds like a polite way of saying junk, sounds like Wall Street dressing up something, and it can be a scary place. But it might surprise you to learn this. According to the investment management folks at Lord Abbett in Boston, the cumulative default rate for AAA-rated corporate bonds was almost three times as high as that default rate for BBB-rated muni bonds for the 10 years that ended in 2009. In other words, you heard that right. The AAA-rated corporates went into default three times as often as the BBB-rated munis. Most of my clients don't have a problem with me buying a AAA-rated corporate bond for them. If I start talking about BBB-rated munis, they think I'm kind of going crazy. So I have to share that statistic with them sometimes. That is not to say that, again, one can be blasé about the risks in this market, and that's why it's really important to attempt to mitigate those risks, again, by diversifying and using good credit research. So as investors, why do we care? Well, consider that money markets are paying almost nothing, like we said earlier. 10-year Treasury bonds yield only 2%, and even 30-year Treasuries only pay about 2.80. That's before you pay taxes on the interest. Now, investment-grade munis and muni funds have yields sort of between 3 and 4% these days, and the CPAs, I think, would tell you you don't pay federal tax on that income. Not bad, and certainly a nice increase from the super low yields. But the high-yield muni world really deserves its name. High-yield muni funds invested nationally right now are paying between 4.5% and 6% without federal tax. And for those of us fortunate enough to live and pay taxes in California, in-state high-yield muni funds have yields from 5.25% to 6.5%-ish, double tax-free. When you adjust that up to account for the tax advantage, that's equal to a taxable return of, 8, maybe 9%. Considering that the U.S. stock market's return for the last 50 years is about 9.5%, a pretty compelling risk-to-reward ratio seems to me. Thank goodness for spooked investors. Now, I know there's Q&A afterwards, but I'm going to anticipate a question here because it comes up every time, and that is, what about when interest rates start going back up again someday? And they will, if history's any guide. It's the only guide we have, of course. For now, that day seems to be a long way off, according to the chairman of our Federal Reserve anyway. And whenever investors do have to face that risk and face that day, at least in this part of the world, they'll be facing it with a 5 or 6% tax-free cushion as opposed to a 2% taxable cushion, again, comparing it to the 10-year Treasury. And it's not just tax-free munis that appear to offer opportunity. Some of these same hangovers from the deep freeze in the credit markets a couple years ago have kept yields high in the corporate high-yield market, too. And here, the European situation is having sort of a different effect. It's leading directly to a new set of opportunities that are likely to become available over the next couple years. Corporate high-yield bonds, like their cousins in the tax-free muni world, are below investment-grade credits, and they have to pay higher interest to induce investors to take the risk on of owning them. And again, below investment-grade sounds a bit scary, but many of the issuers in this market are household names you see and use and do business with, probably yourselves, Ford Motor Credit, Sprint, Nextel, Harrah's Entertainment. The opportunity here is twofold. Again, first, just the pure high rates right now demanded by investors who remain spooked by visions of 08 and the scary headlines today. Today, the current yields in this market are sort of in the 6 to 8% range, depending on how aggressive the different funds are postured. But here, these yields might go higher soon, not because the bonds go down in price, like we talked about earlier, but due to a large increase in the supply of new bonds basically being forced onto the market from our friends in Europe. Right now, the market for high-yield corporate bonds here in the U.S. is about $1.25 trillion. The European high-yield bond market is about a fourth of that size. But one is told and one can read, it's estimated there's another $1 trillion of below-investment-grade assets and loans on the banks of the European, on the balance sheets of the European banks. Part of the problem over there. Well, a lot of people think that those assets are going to be repackaged into high-yield bonds and offered into the capital markets over the next few years. And it's already started. We heard recently about a big, major European cable company, kind of the Comcast of, I can't remember which country, I think it was Germany, pricing a bond yield, offering bonds that paid 9.5% interest. Similar issuers here in the U.S. are paying 6.5 or 7. There's going to be so much paper for sale. That's Wall Street speak for bonds. There's going to be the potential is setting up for all these assets coming for sale out of the banks in Europe. That makes investors demand a higher yield. Some of these bond funds might be able to be buying that paper at higher yields, and the income stream is going to go up to the investors if that all plays out. So despite super short-term rates here in the U.S. and rates that are expected to stay low, if our chairman of our Federal Reserve has it right, rates in this market not only are high, they might go higher. Now, if we have any thrill seekers in the group, we're going to talk about one more area of the bond market, sail through some really dangerous waters before we get to stocks. If this last sector of the bond market were introduced like a mystery guest, it would have quite a bio. This market only appeared on the investment scene quite recently, during the housing boom. That's a hint. It consists of over 60,000 individual securities. Most of them were rated AAA when they were issued. Now almost none of them are. Despite this market being really large, it's almost the exact same size as the corporate high yield market, $1.25 trillion, it's not yet bona fide or established as an asset class. It came onto the market and then got creamed too soon, got downgraded too soon. The investment community has not accepted it, let alone really embraced it. So unlike high yield bonds, where every pension fund has X percent of it dedicated to high yield bonds, and every mutual fund has a me too fund in a lot of different asset classes, that's not the case with this market. Finally, the great majority of these bonds will never ever trade at or mature at 100 cents on the dollar ever again. Their maturity values have been permanently impaired. In other words, they're below 100 cents on the dollar. So who is the mystery guest, and why in the world would anyone consider investing in it? Well, some of you might have guessed what it is or gotten close, and its name is kind of a mouthful, non-agency RMBS. That Wall Street speak stands for residential mortgage-backed bonds. In other words, bonds backed by mortgages, just like homes on all of ours, and this part's italicized. The mortgages and the bonds are not guaranteed by the U.S. government, not guaranteed by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. So this is the market that caused so much of the problem 3 years ago. This market contains the famous, or infamous, toxic assets. This is where the defaults and the foreclosures and the short sales and the evictions and the general tales of woe are being told. Does anybody wonder why this market has been almost completely orphaned, not abandoned, orphaned? Well, but as we said earlier, you can't have good prices alongside good news. And you can have markets that feel comfortable and which are popular with investors, but that's not likely where you're going to get the best values, I don't think. We also said that credit research is vitally important. That's an understatement in this market. Having the technical ability and the analytical horsepower to really research and understand these securities all the way down to the level of the underlying mortgage borrower, people like you and me, is no small feat. And I think you can make the case that only a handful of firms in the whole country really have that capability. But the people who are able to do that research can find bonds with cash flows as high as 10% and whose price might go up in value even if the real estate and labor markets get worse. This is partly because many of these bonds, and again, their maturity values have been impaired, but they're trading at 50 or 60 cents on the dollar. And since the number of new bonds being issued in this market is absolutely zero, and they're never coming back, I don't think, as people pay off or refinance mortgages, and it is happening, this market is shrinking by as much as 10, 15, some people say almost 20% per year. That's an unusual set of circumstances. And this info just in, I got this off the web today. It's a white paper that Bernanke sent to the heads of the Housing and Banking Committees. And the gist of it is, in this report, we provide a framework for thinking about directions policymakers might take to help the housing market. And they've made a lot of sort of initial stabs at this. But I heard a fund manager in this specific niche of the bond market reference this today, so we went to the web to look at it. Maybe the cavalry is getting ready to ride over the hill and make a rescue effort. We're hearing chatter that they're going to put together, potentially, government slash private pools of capital so that big institutional investors, unlike you and me trying to buy one home that's in foreclosure and buy it cheap, so that these big investors can buy hundreds and hundreds of homes at one time, convert a lot of them into rental units, which would make sense. We've all been hearing stories about these rents going up so much. That could change things quickly. I have no idea if that's actually going to happen. But things can change fast in these markets. It continuously strikes me, thinking back on the crash, the darkest days, to my way of thinking, were in November of 08. It was really bleak. You know, GE couldn't roll over its 30-day loan. General Electric. Well, all was dark at that point, or it certainly felt like it, November of 08. By the second half of March of 09, the S&P 500 and these credit markets that we've been talking about were just going straight up the page. That 4 months seemed like a long time back then. But when you think about it, it happened fast. So things can change quickly in these markets. I think it's important not to lose sight of that. Back to this market for the non-guaranteed mortgage bonds. This market is not for the faint of heart. But if it is a good opportunities rarely are. But please, remember every risk disclaimer you've ever read in your whole life if you end up exploring this world. It's actually probably pretty good news that exploring it is not all that easy to do. Now, the last opportunity we're going to touch on tonight is good old-fashioned American stocks. But before we do that, a quick word on something I learned the other day in the retirement account and tax penalty world. Again, I'm certainly not an expert here, but we have a working knowledge of this, working with clients all day long. And we all know this is specific to the retirement accounts. When we turn 70 and a half, in that year, or actually the following year, you need to start taking RMDs, required minimum distributions, out of your IRA or your 401ks, all of them. Well, the IRS has lost its sense of humor about missed RMDs, missed required distributions. It's estimated that $400 million over the past couple of years, each year, has not been withdrawn correctly. They want the tax on that money, not surprisingly. If an RMD is purposefully missed, and supposedly if you can prove you missed it in error, you can get away from this, I wouldn't want to try it. If you miss one on purpose, choose not to take it, in other words, the penalty on the amount not withdrawn is 50%. And again, that was my reaction, too. And I thought I heard that you also owe tax on the whole amount in addition to that penalty. I couldn't confirm that on the IRS's website. Anyway, 50% is bad enough, I think. And again, this pertains to all the IRAs and or 401ks a person has. With people changing jobs a lot more these days, could be a problem. It's tough enough to save and invest money successfully. Let's be sure you and your family and friends don't donate 50% chunks of it by missing one of these distributions. I think you can do a better job with the money than they can. Maybe it's just me. Okay. Lastly, let's turn to a few thoughts about the stock market. I have a few facts and quotes, and I know I'm going through a lot of figures, and I apologize for that. But these are just a few facts and quotes that might help us give a picture about the current market here in the U.S. I'll name the source of a few of them, of each of them, as we go along. Please don't get the impression I'm a wild-eyed bull, just because I'm going to read you some bullish facts. Admittedly, I'll give you the punchline first. I just wonder what is going to happen. Well, I think I can say that. I suppose there's an if, but I think it's a win. When all this capital that is stuck in cash, earning nothing, decides to go somewhere, what is going to happen to these markets? Maybe it won't come out of cash. I can't tell you that. I wish I could. But I just kind of wonder, once it comes out of its cave and starts to seek higher returns, people with $50 million in the bank can earn 10 basis points. Again, that's Wall Street speak for a tenth of a percent. Most of us can't hit our goals earning 0.1% per year. I just kind of wonder what's going to happen when that capital seeks higher returns someday. So here are the factoids. For the 10-year period that ended in 08, the U.S. market had a negative return. That's only happened four times since 1926. After the first four times, the following 10 years saw average annual gains of over 14% per year. I know that's redundant, but I think I think it's important. And the total cumulative gains were over 100%. That's from Franklin Templeton and others. In other words, when the market's done as horribly as it has these last 10 or 12 years in the past, and who knows if it's prologue, one can hope, it's tended to do really well. Life being a regression to the mean exercise is sort of the point there. Here's another factoid. This one's from Merrill Lynch Wealth Management folks. Wall Street has a statistic they use called the equity risk premium. It's a calculation or a statistic that tries to determine what's the extra return investors might get or might anticipate from stocks compared to bonds. It's a relative valuation measure. How cheap are stocks or bonds versus each other? Suffice it to say, at the moment, that number is at a 30-year extreme in favor of stocks. It's more than twice the average level of the past 30 years, 7%. So take those treasuries, low as they are, add the 7. That's what a lot of academic folks, research folks on Wall Street, it's not just Merrill Lynch, would tell you the market is likely to give to investors over the long term from here. Let's hope they're right. According to J.P. Morgan Private Bank, the long-term price to forward earnings, in other words, this coming year's earnings, for U.S. stocks is about 15.5 times. Right now it's 12 times. That would be undervalued. Again, if history's any guide, let's hope it is. Dividends matter. This is from Ned Davis Research, a big institutional research firm down in Florida. Dividends matter a lot, especially when interest rates on things like treasuries are 2, and you can get a lot more than that in really top quality companies' dividends. From 1972 through 2009, a list of dividend growers, simply companies paying consistent and rising dividends, you know, the good guys, Procter & Gamble and all the white hats. That list of companies returned 9% per year on average for that time period. The universe of stocks with no dividends at all returned a little bit more than 1%. I know which I'd rather have. Two quotes. These are both from Barron's in last fall, and they just came next to each other, and it just really struck me. Two extremely successful big money managers. They run big money, I mean. Both kind of two different roads to the same realm. First one was a fellow named Mark Holowesko. I doubt you'd ever heard of him. He used to run a big chunk of the Templeton Mutual Fund complex before he left and went out on his own several years ago. In Barron's, he was making the case for blue chip stocks. Here's this quote from Barron's November 14th. Our top 10 stock holdings yield 3.5% with the 10-year treasury at 2%. If these companies grow their dividends at the same pace over the next 10 years, their stocks would have to fall 40% to have the same return as a 10-year treasury. The other investor interviewed in Barron's last fall is named Joe Rosenberg. He's been the investment man for the billionaire Tisch family in New York, who control Lowe's Corporation and CNA Insurance for years. And he's been a successful investor on Wall Street for 50 years. In December, he described himself, this isn't an exact quote, but like a kid in a candy store, because the best, the cheapest stocks in the market are the best companies in the world. I had to read that a couple of times to make sure I was getting him correctly. Here's the quote. Here's the exact quote of how he summed up the current environment. We're at an inflection point in history, and that's what I want to emphasize. I'm not talking about a trade. I don't know what's going to happen next week or next month. But in terms of economic history, the equity market looks a lot like the treasury bond market in the early 1980s, when I had the most difficult time convincing people they ought to buy bonds at 15% yields. Equities could easily generate 10% annualized total returns over the next 5 to 10 years, and they would still not be overvalued at that point. That's the beauty of it. End quote. Now, I don't know if the factoids I mentioned are going to mean anything, and I certainly don't know if those two quotes are going to prove to be prophetic, but here are a few things we do know. I do know the S&P hit the current level of about 1,300 all the way back in April of 1999, and it's about 20% below the highs that it made in both 2000 and 2007. Now, we use these Morningstar stock data sheets, you know, with all these facts and figures. They only go back to 2001, but that's pretty close to when the market made its highs. So let's look at a couple final facts with a list of blue chip stocks. In 2001, the combined net income
of Exxon, GE, Intel, IBM, and Walmart was about $43 billion. Over the past 12 months, it was $100 billion, 2.5 times greater. If you bought a share of each of those five stocks in 2000, the dividends that year you earned were $2.50. Last year, IBM's dividend was almost $3, and all five of them added up were $7.33, up almost 300% since 2001. So if you remember that old show, The Honeymooners, with Jackie Gleason, and, you know, he used to say, one of these days, Alice, one of these days, maybe investors will be rewarded for suffering through the past 12 years, and especially the last five or so. One of these days, maybe the market will be popular, and people will be talking about it at cocktail parties and barbecues again, and bragging about it. And in closing, maybe, just maybe, if we're really lucky, we pray to the right market gods, this quote from Merrill Lynch's chief equity strategist will come true. 2012 could represent the beginning of the end of the great bear market in equities. All I have to say about that is, from his lips to God's ear, thank you again for coming this evening, and thank you very much for your attention. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker has been Ted Rice. I'm Kerry Curtis, your host for this evening. And so let's start in with some audience questions, Ted, if that's all right. We have quite a few of them. And this has to do with investing in individual stocks. The question, the audience question, question is, with hedge funds making multiple trades per day in a given stock, how can the average investor compete? Should he or she simply trade, not trade individual stocks?
That's a great question. This super high frequency trader, they call them HFTs, high frequency traders. These people are doing thousands and thousands of trades a minute with their computers programmed to do that somehow. I really don't understand it. I think the word compete is really important right there. I don't think one could compete trying to do that and trying to outgun them at that sort of really short-term gain. I'd like to think it doesn't change the fact that if Bristol Myers is at X price and has a 4.25% dividend, and the dividend's going to go up every year for the next 10 years like it has the last 10 years, and I'm pulling that out of the air, don't hold me to that, Procter, Johnny John, you know, one of these great companies, I'd like to think that all that frenetic buying and selling intraday isn't going to change where that investment value is going over the next 5 or 10 years. So I don't think any of us can compete with those guys trying to do that, but I don't think it really changes the investment values and where they're going, and I'd like to think those investment values eventually would be reflected in the stock's price.
So just to sum that up, if you want to do day trading, maybe you shouldn't try to compete with those guys, but if you're holding a stock for the long-haul value of it, then you shouldn't hold back.
That's exactly right.
Okay. My next question, I have two questions about inflation. One is, how should you take inflation into account in your investment, managing one's investments? And a question from an audience member, what is an inflation-adjusted bond, and are they any good?
Oh, boy. I shouldn't say, oh, boy, after every question like that. Inflation can play a huge role. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I know there's a lot of talk about low inflation and even deflation during the crisis. Somebody forgot to tell the treasurer of certain schools, that young lady in the back can tell you. And I don't know about you, but they forgot to tell the Chevron where I gas up my car and et cetera. The main enemy of the bondholder, especially the high-quality bonds, over long periods of time is inflation, because you buy a bond for $10,000, 20 years from now it comes due at $10,000, but the $10,000 doesn't buy the same basket of goods and services. And if inflation takes hold in a big way, like in the late 70s was the last time it happened, that's when you get a bond bear market. One would think a bear market for high-quality bonds is out there somewhere, and it's going to be awful. People my age or older are the only people that remember what a bear market in bonds looks like, so you do have to be careful. That's one of the reasons why it's kind of counterintuitive to me and just only me. To my way of thinking, the highest grade bonds have the highest risk at the moment, which is quite counterintuitive because their interest rates are so low. When inflation comes back, they could really get hurt. Inflation-adjusted bonds, I'm assuming they're referring to what are known as TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protection Securities. It's tough, and they have mutual funds of those, and they have ETFs of those, exchange-traded funds. TIPS are Treasury bonds whose interest rates are quite low and set, but the maturity value of the bond is adjusted upwards every, I think it's 6 months, based on CPI or one of those measures. I'm not an expert in the TIPS. At the moment, they look okay. I don't know if investors are really going to make back the super. One of the auctions went off at a negative interest rate last week. Is inflation going to take hold such that accepting literally a negative interest rate is going to make you glad you bought that security in a big way? I don't know enough to really answer that question intelligently. It's a tricky area of the bond market, and I usually want the bonds for income, like these high-yield guys we've been discussing, or I want to buy treasuries if the world is running away from risk, like in the summer, because that's the only thing that goes up when people are running away from risk. The inflation protection guys are kind of in the middle, and we don't do a lot there. So I'm sorry if I disappointed anybody.
That's fine. Thank you. In terms of the perspective of a person doing his or her own investing, can you explain the difference between commission-based investing through a traditional broker and the kind of what do you call discretionary investing such as you do mostly?
Sure. The traditional way of doing things, and for many decades, the only way the Wall Street firms did things was you open a brokerage account and you called someone like me or someone like me called you, and you would have this portfolio, and I would ring you up and I would say, Kerry, today is the day we're going to sell GM and buy GE because of the following reasons. And at the end of that conversation, you decide to either do so or not do so. And I got paid a commission when you did that. And believe it or not, some of you in the room will remember this, these commissions were fixed until 1974. They were fixed. Merrill Lynch and Payne Webber and E.F. Hutton and all these folks back in the day, they all had the same commission structure, no competition. It only ended in 1974. That's when Chuck Schwab started Schwab. Not surprisingly, that's a conflict of interest. If I'm causing or helping cause a buy or sell in your account and getting paid, obviously the more activity, the more I get paid. I'd like to think I'm an ethical guy, and it's an ethical industry most of the time. But it's purely and simply, it's a conflict of interest. The whole street, Merrill Lynch and the other firms, started making a move towards a different structure where we charge a fee based on the assets in the account. So if the assets are going up, our fee's going up, and the buying and selling doesn't generate anything at all. We have no incentive, literally, to buy or sell because it doesn't generate any revenue. As a subset of that, some of those accounts, there are two types of fee-based accounts. One is a traditional account where I have to call you and say, I think we should do this or that, and then we do it together, again, no commission, or where I have discretion or control. And I might have accounts for everybody in this room, and tomorrow morning I can press a button and put 3% of the assets, let's say, or 5% into one of these funds or into IBM. Point, click, it's done. I don't have to call anybody because I own the decision-making power. Again, I don't get paid anything to do the buy or the sell, and I have a higher level of responsibility, et cetera, et cetera. Some people in our industry want that responsibility. Some don't. That's a subject for another day. But that's kind of it. We went from being paid to buy and sell really to being, I'm not trying to sugarcoat it, to being paid for trying to make the assets grow, which I think is a better outcome for everybody.
Great. Thanks for that. And the next audience member's question is, what have we learned since 2008 about index funds compared to actively managed mutual funds?
Hmm. That's another really good question.
We have a good audience.
in index funds, just to at the risk of going too slow for some people in the audience or whatever, index funds are just, think of the S&P 500. You're not trying to beat the market. You're just trying to be the market. And for many, many years, the only index fund really of any size out there was Vanguard had an S&P 500 index fund for a million years. That really started to change when the access to a whole lot of different indexes changed and grew dramatically starting in the very late 90s and then all through the 2000s with these so-called ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Now, not just the S&P 500, but you can buy the index of the emerging market stocks, the emerging market bonds, you can buy the steel stocks as a little group, and you're buying the index and no one's trying to beat the market. What have we learned since 2008 between actively managed funds that are trying to pick the stocks versus these indexes, which are just set list of known stocks that no brain is picking, the market has picked them? I think through the 08 experience, what most people wish they had known before going into 08, that some of the active managers who have the flexibility to not just invest in stocks, but to tone down the stock exposure, maybe turn up some safe bonds when the crisis was starting to bubble, some of those funds protected people's capital really well. Did the actively managed or index guys really dodge the 08 problem? No. Did they all recover a lot? Yes. So it's really sort of the subset of flexible funds that don't have to stay 100% invested in stocks. They earned their stripes and in many cases proved their worth in that experience because they were able to control the risk of the big downside in 08.
So the moral of the story is prefer investments where there's some room to maneuver and some judgment can be used.
We do personally, yeah. We and my folks, we do, yeah. If we either want it to be sort of not managed at all or really managed, i.e. they can say, I want to run away from stocks and tone down the stock exposure for our clients. We want them to have that flexibility.
Right. There's a series of questions from the audience about specific kinds of investments. So I'll just give them to you one at a time. This question is, what is your take on government EE bonds?
Oh, the savings bonds?
Right.
I'm not an expert. I frankly can't remember which ones those are, so I apologize for that. I think anything, if it's a long-term and it's a way to get started saving, I think it's a good idea. We have some somewhere that a friend of our son number two gave him when he was 2 years old. They're probably coming due pretty soon. But like all the Treasury securities these days, really low rate of interest, extreme safety. So if you want that and you don't want to have to worry about these European headlights and so forth, there could be a place there.
Okay. And the next question is, what part do you feel emerging markets can play in the future? And what part should they be in one's portfolio?
Well, the second one, I have to fall down on the lawyer's spear and say it really depends on your own risk tolerance and all of that. And I would never say, oh, gosh, one should have 15 or 5 or 25% in emerging markets, because it really does depend on how much risk you can handle. The generic answer as to what role do the emerging markets play, even within that, there's sort of a subset of questions. It's one thing to go buy companies in the emerging markets. It seems to me it's another less risky and possibly quite rewarding idea to invest in blue chip companies that have big exposure because they sell a lot of stuff in the emerging markets. So even as a subset, even within the emerging markets, there are a couple different ways to play it. Investing in the emerging markets doesn't just mean you're investing directly in those markets. You might buy Nestle, all of whose growth going forward is going to come from the emerging markets because those markets are growing. When you step back for a second and try to step back from the day-to-day volatility and the headlines and the yelling and the shouting, so to speak, the numbers are just so compelling. It's just unbelievable. Picture one graph, and I'll try and draw it from your vantage point. It's consumption of barrels of oil per capita, per person, in different countries. And this is 1900, and here we are now. And here's the U.S., and here comes Henry Ford, and then here comes the post-war boom and the building of the freeways all over America. And the line, of course, just goes boom like that. And about 5 or 10 years later, Japan does the same thing. And here comes Korea. And then here come other markets. And Europe is obviously in there. Well, way over at the end of the graph, basically now, or starting 2 years ago, there's two little lines that have not even come up off zero. And, of course, it's India and China. And you kind of think through the implications of that. You know, a couple billion people entering to middle classhood of some in some stripe and becoming consumers, and they want the things we have, and I'm not trying to make a social comment by saying that. The power of the growth in those markets is just immense. The right way to play it in which countries, and do you try and do it yourself or give it to a fund manager? Again, that's a subject for a one-on-one conversation, but it strikes me that opportunities, those opportunities are just enormous. You have to be careful, you know. They have scandals over there, and there's inflation and other things, but as a generic statement, the growth over there and those numbers are just so compelling, you can't ignore it.
Right. Thank you. The next kind of investment that's being asked about is residential real estate investment trusts.
Oh.
And the second part two to that question is, how does that compare to that's a different question. Go ahead.
Okay. Again, just to get the nomenclature for everybody, residential real estate investment trusts, REITs are a special type of stock that are traded on the exchange, and they're sort of pass-through vehicles. They're like a company like IBM or whatever, but instead of making computers, they just own buildings or homes. And they don't pay taxes at the corporate level. They pass all the income to you and I as investors in real estate investment trust. Quick aside, I can't help myself. My father launched the first one in 1971 for Bank of America, but that's another story. maybe he'll listen. So REITs as a class are basically a way to buy real estate on the New York Stock Exchange, so to speak. The residential REITs are twofold. Most of them own rental property. They don't tend to own single-family homes, but they own a lot of apartment buildings, and with the rents going up, the stocks have done really well. As an aside, that's one thing that was so intriguing to me about this white paper that Bernanke sent over to the Senate Finance Committee types. You know, if they're trying to organize big pools of capital to buy single-family homes, I'm going to be looking for ways for us to maybe look at trying to do that for our investors, because some people might form mutual funds to do that. That's what happened after the mortgage mess happened. But as a general rule, the residential REITs are up a lot, but they're really good companies, and this tightness in the rental market doesn't look to me like it's going down anytime soon. You have the same risk as the long-term high-quality bonds. When as and if inflation takes hold and interest rates go up, could be a dangerous place. On the other hand, if interest rates are going up because the economy has finally gotten off the canvas and is fighting again, could probably be pretty good. They tend to pay pretty good dividends.
Thanks. Earlier you mentioned mutual funds of bonds, and you also made a passing reference to exchange-traded funds. And so if you want to get into the bond market through some mechanism like that, what are the trade-offs between a straight bond mutual fund and an exchange-traded fund?
Another really good question. ETFs or exchange-traded funds are a subset, relatively new on the investment scene, of the broader group of mutual funds. They're mutual funds, but they trade on the stock exchange. And they have some other nuances to them. The main thing is, for the most part, and this is starting to change, a bond mutual fund, some person or persons, a team of persons, is going to buy these bonds, and they're going to buy the GM bonds and sell the GE bonds and do all that to try to make the right moves on behalf of their investors. The exchange-traded funds, kind of like the exchange-traded stock funds, which again started as the S&P 500, the exchange-traded bond funds tend to buy, I'm going to bias this, they tend to buy dumb lists. They buy a bond index. So, for example, in the high-yield bonds that we were talking about, if you buy one of the high-yield ETFs, it's a dumb list. It's just an index of bonds that the index providers have cooped up. There's no judgment in it. They had a lot of GM bonds. When we decided to buy the high-yield market in the spring of 2009, God be thanked, we didn't want to buy the ETFs because there's a lot of really crummy paper in there. I sat down with a bond fund manager this close, and I said, I want to buy the high-yield market, but I'm scared to death. And the fellow described to me what the top 10 bonds were in his portfolio. I said, that doesn't sound risky. I'll spare you the details, but that's the main difference. Open-ended traditional mutual funds are going to be a bond fund with a brain. Let's hope the brain is qualified to do a good job. The ETFs are going to tend to be a static list, and you're going to own all the high-yield bonds, good and bad, and no one can kind of decide to sell the bad ones. So if I'm going to buy the S&P 500, that's fine. If I'm going to buy something like high yield, I want to make sure someone with a brain is buying the stocks. So I hope that answers the question. I mean, the bonds, excuse me.
Right. So your answer sort of tilts against exchange-traded funds
for
the bonds.
Especially in the racier areas of the bond markets that we were talking about, especially in the high yield, yes.
Okay. And another audience member has the same question, but about stocks. So it's a mutual fund of stocks compared to an exchange-traded fund of stocks.
Again, generically speaking, the same idea, a traditional open-ended fund. And that just means it doesn't trade on the exchange. You do your buys and sells at 4 p.m. in the afternoon, and some manager or managers are selecting the stocks. They're trying to beat the market. The ETFs tend to be static lists of stocks. You can see exactly what they own every day on the website. They started out just replicating indexes, S&P 500, the small cap stocks, whatever. The lines are starting to blur because some of the index funds kind of have a brain now, not a person, but they'll run lists of, oh, we want to buy all the stocks with good and rising dividends. This guy wants to buy the S&P 500, but they filter it not by market cap, in other words, size, but they filter it by what guys have the best return on equity, and it's a computer-generated model that might be better than human beings' brains. That's a subject for another debate. So I'm not trying to go too far away from the question, but generically, a traditional mutual fund, you're going to be hiring a group of people who are going to be trying to add value and, quote, beat the market. the ETFs, the generic answer is you're just buying a set index. You're not trying to beat the market. You're trying to be the market or a subset of the market. That's the other thing these ETFs have revolutionized. Up until just a few years ago, if you wanted to buy the emerging markets, you had to buy the Oppenheimer Emerging Markets Fund or whatever. Now you can just buy the index, and you know you're not going to underperform the index. You're not going to outperform the index. You are the index. You also can buy these very narrow slices of the market if you want to. You can buy the steel stocks. You can buy the small cap growth stocks in Brazil. You can buy the fertilizer stocks. You can buy the automotive stocks. So it's enabled investors to access different parts of these markets. These ETFs have really has revolutionized the industry in the last 10 years or so.
Thank you. What do you think of lending money to individuals through companies like LendingTree?
I don't know a lot about that.
Neither do I.
I've heard about LendingTree, and I've seen the name, and I don't know what their business is. Some of these folks, there's some interesting business models out there. You kind of have an ethical debate going on. You know, they have these, there are companies that do really well in bad times. There's some publicly traded pawn shops, and there's publicly traded check cashing stores, you know, charging people these, I don't know how they get away with the interest rates. And I'm not accusing LendingTree of that. I don't know enough really to answer that question.
Okay, so let's let that one pass.
Fair enough.
Sorry I asked it.
No, don't.
Because I don't know much about it either. And the next question is, should individual investors actively hedge against downside risk? And can you do that via mutual funds?
Oh, another great question.
I told you we had a good
idea. There are a lot of layers to that question because hedging's also gotten much easier if one knows what one's doing, or I should say is willing to invest the time to sort of learn about it. Some mutual funds have that capability internally. Back to the flexible guys we were talking about earlier, flexible funds. Some funds say right in the prospectus, we can go sell S&P futures to hedge market risk and all that Wall Street-y, hedge fundy type of stuff. There's a couple of funds and ETFs that are basically dedicated short funds. If you buy the fund, you're taking on a negative market exposure. Again, this world of ETFs has greatly expanded that. You can buy a fund that moves inversely with the S&P 500 dollar for dollar. You can buy one that moves 2 or 3x the S&P's daily movement up or down. And you can buy it on margin and they trade options with it. Whee! That's what a lot of these super fast guys are doing. It's so, again, there's a lot of layers to the answer to that question. But hedging also got much easier with these ETFs without getting that esoteric. If a client has $1 million invested and it's all in equities, and let's say it's low-cost GE and all those stocks that great-grandma and grandpa bought, and you don't want to sell them because of the taxes and the loyalty and the dividends and all that, but you're afraid Europe's going to blow up, and I think I said $1 million, let's say it's $1 million, you can just go sell $500,000 to make up a number worth of the S&P 500 index fund short, or buy, if you have an extra $500,000, $500,000 worth of the inverse S&P 500 fund, and your market exposure just got cut in half. It's very efficient. Doesn't cost a lot. You owe the dividends, because if you're short, you don't get dividends, you owe them. But that was impossible to do except for hedge funds who could trade futures up until they invented these ETFs. So it's gotten much easier. Doesn't mean it's gotten easier for us to make money doing it. It's not easy to short the market because the downdrafts tend to happen, especially these days, so fast. You kind of have to be short all the time or figure out a timing mechanism to jump on it. I mean, just look at the decline that started July 27th. It was so fast. The volatility of that decline, you have to go back to 1987, and before that, you have to go back to 19, this isn't funny, you have to go back to 1942 when Germany was overrunning France to find a number of the statistical anomalies that happened in late July and August. Being able to jump on that profitably from the short side, i.e. from hedging, is not easy.
Okay, so that's not for sissies is what you're saying. Okay, so you...
like so many things in life, right?
That's what they say about old age.
Right.
Okay, well, common advice to people who are managing their own investments is that you should take no more than 4%, or maybe some people say 5% from your portfolio each year in order to make it to the end, if whatever that is. And so what's your take on that? You know, based on the numbers you were talking about earlier, it seemed like 4% might be kind of really conservative.
I'm not going to say that's another really good question, but it is. And I've seen those same studies, and it seems like a very reasonable number. And it really depends, and you can't tell this in advance. Are you unlucky enough to start in 2007, and your first couple of years are a steep downdraft? Are you lucky to start in 1982, right at the dawn of a 20-year bull market or 18-year bull market? I think that's a really reasonable number. It's a number we all use. That's why I'm very interested in these bond funds that yield more than that on a cash basis, because then we can reinvest some money as well as taking money out. I think with all of us living longer and with all of us dependent on our own investment success through these 401ks, especially the people, you know, call it age 40 and up, who are going to live so much longer, and people already are, obviously, I think that might change the way some of those numbers work. Not that the 4% is going to change, but trying to back into it by having enough capital so you buy bonds and get the 4% might not be the right thing to do. The right thing to do might be to invest for total return, some stocks, some bonds in a mix, take some income out, and take a little principal out if you have to accomplish that 4%. In other words, don't invest for the 4% cash income. Invest for total return and then withdraw 4% income plus some of the corpus as you go along. The longer you plan on living, and the less money you have, the more you're going to have to do that, because the bonds won't do it for you, especially if you stick with the high-grade stuff, because they ain't paying 4%. And so that's why I was sort of going through that exercise. That's why we're so focused on these high-yield markets, trying to control the risk but earn rates of return that will help people make that. I'm not trying to give an advertisement for what I just said, but...
There's been a lot of talk and news, bad news, mostly about the euro. And so how should an individual investor take what may or may not happen in Europe into account in short-run investments right now?
A couple answers. Have some cash on the sidelines so the next time the headlines get scary and there's a 15 or 20% dip, you'll have the wherewithal to spend the cash and buy it in U.S. stocks, not in European stocks. But literally, if markets are going to be volatile, you just have to have either some real safe assets, even though I said they had lousy returns, just there as ballast in the, you know, lead in the keel of the sailboat, you know. Be ready to buy the next dip. Don't be surprised by the next 15% drop in 3 weeks. How could we be surprised by one if it happens again? Having said that, I wish we could take a poll, but would I say that Bernanke and the five other major central banks announced a huge swap lines agreement November 30th that might have really dramatically altered the picture in Europe. Does that ring a bell with anybody's? I didn't think so. The relative strength line of banks, in other words, banks were underperforming. Again, I'm doing this backwards for you guys. Banks were going like this all last year in relative terms. They were going down while the market was going flat. Then they turn on a dime and start going up in relative terms, bank stocks here in the U.S. and globally. On November 30th, Bernanke and the other central banks announced a program allowing for unlimited dollar funding to the banks around the world. It's called a swap lines agreement. It didn't get as much press, and like I say, when I say to people, it took me a while to sort of dig through this stuff. That's what you do if you're a guy like me. I guess you read this stuff. And then the Europeans did this thing they call the LTRO, the long-term refinancing operation, right before Christmas. They may have greatly diminished the nightmare outcome from happening. Lehman Brothers 2 may not happen on their watch. That may be what they just said to us, and that's why these markets are acting so much better and volatility's down so much in the last 6 weeks. I'm not trying to say that we can forget about the problem. It doesn't change the problem, i.e. all the debt over there and everything, but it might change. It might have dramatically lowered the odds that the problem causes a nightmare. Lehman Brothers Take Two, you know, showing at a theater near you. That might have greatly been diminished by their actions. So I don't know the answer to the euro, but at the moment the markets are much less worried about it.
Thank you. Now, here's a question with a subtext from one of the audience members. Since 1950, my assets, stocks and bonds, have increased 20 times.
All right.
How did I do?
Well, I'd have to check the numbers, but that's what happens. When you look at what happens to a growing business over a long period of time, no other assets do it. You know, your home will go up two or threefold in your lifetime and all that sort of stuff. You buy GE or Northern Trust or Bristol Myers or, you know, fill in the blank and hold it for a long time, they go up a lot. And that's why I'm so intrigued by the fact that these great companies with these growing businesses haven't done anything in 12 years. I grant you they may have been overvalued, and they were, certainly a lot of them in 2000 and whatnot, the peak of the tech boom. But that's the intriguing idea. If that's going to happen again, and we're going to be rewarded in the future like we were in the past over the long term, aren't we getting closer and closer to better and better returns the longer we go through this bleh that's been going on for 12 years? It seems to me, I'm an optimistic guy and I'm in the industry, maybe I'm biased, but that's why I'm so intrigued by this idea that the blue chip stocks haven't done anything for 12 years. But I think that person's to be congratulated, whoever they are.
Yeah, I'm not going to ask him or her to identify themselves. We've run out of time, and so please join me in thanking Ted Rice for his comments here this evening.
Thanks again for coming.
I'm Kerry Curtis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.